Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Prizman, and I'm really excited about this episode. Today, I'm joined by Sarah Vereen, who is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of the essay collection Mine, a finalist for a Lambda Literary Award. She was a National Endowment for the Arts Fellow and teaches in the creative writing program at Arizona State University. Her new book is called To Name the Bigger Lie. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
I'm so glad to talk about this book with you because, wow, I have a lot of thoughts. And I thought maybe the best way in is to confess my jealousy when I first started reading the book, when you talk about having a teacher who was so charismatic and inspiring that you were taught to question everything, which is a thing that I did not have in the mid-90s in high school.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it's unique that to have a teacher, especially in public school. I don't know if you were in public school.
I was.
To have a teacher in a public school in Florida, which is where I grew up, who taught us philosophy. I just, in retrospect, I feel really lucky, as complicated as he ended up being, you know, as a teacher. It's still pretty amazing that I was introduced to some of those big questions like, who am I? Do I exist? What does existence mean? Like, is anything true? Like, all of those really big picture questions at the same time that I was coming of age. Because I think when we're coming of age, we're naturally kind of thinking about those. But if we're not given like the scaffolding to move into that more sort of philosophical realm, it's easier to also get distracted by like, why do I have a big pimple on my nose? Like, does it yeah. like me? Which I also thought about, you know, as a teenager. But I think it was nice to have those. I really am thankful for that.
And you did. I really enjoyed hearing about you as a teenager at like kind of trying on different vibes. And most importantly, coming out in the mid-90s, also a thing that wasn't very common at the time.
Yeah, especially I think in the South. I mean, Florida is this weird realm. Yeah. People don't think of Florida as the South, but it's definitely not New York City or San Francisco, you know? So yeah, I do think coming out at that point, I mean, Ellen wasn't even out yet, right? So like, it was a time in which it felt more lonely. And I think I have a part in the book where I started to realize that there were gay pride flags. and you know, I think that that's, you know, I just think about that idea of like the presence of gay people, especially when you're a place in that period in time and in the South, like any moment in which you can see yourself reflected in the outside world is so satisfying. But I also think that it sort of primed my way of thinking about the world, which is part of the book. Like when you're queer in a world that's not as accepting of queerness, then you're always looking for signs and confirmation that you're okay. So you're kind of reading the world in a way that's in a different way than those that who are not queer. And I do feel like that wouldn't have happened if I'd been in New York City in the early 2000s, right? Like there's a different way of existing when you definitely feel the sense of being a minority. So yes, it was a much harder time to be queer than it is now.
And then of course, in terms of finding community and asking big questions, we take for granted that the internet it connects us to so many different ways of thinking, and it's worth kind of acknowledging that I think I'm almost exactly the same age as you are. And we got by based on looking in encyclopedias. And there wasn't much.
Yeah. Time. Yeah. And also reading, you know, I think reading other books, I have these like fond memories of going to the University of South Florida Library when I was in high school. And often it was for like researching, you know, stuff for school. But there were also times that I would just like look up, you know, lesbian stuff. And later, and this is not in the book, but in college, I got really interested in queer history. And I volunteered one summer with NYAD Press, which is one of the first lesbian presses in the United States. It was based in Tallahassee, like outside of Tallahassee, Florida, in a little town called Havana. And I worked there and I would send out every day, you know, this is in the early 2000s. Lesbian literature that it still was sent out in like paperbacks. so that, you know, to protect people's privacy so that nobody would know you were getting a lesbian novel. So, yeah, I think that that idea of like the knowledge of queer culture, knowledge of that sort of community was much harder to access, right? And it felt so much more precious when you actually got it. Whereas now you can just, it's much easier to just go online and find that sort of knowledge. And I'm glad for that. But yeah. It did mean that when you found those bits of knowledge that helped you understand yourself or helped you understand like who you were in the world, like you really clung to them. They meant so much.
And so I was jealous of you again when you, your junior year, you have a course actually called Theory of Knowledge. And Mr. Wiles, which is what you call your teacher, who taught you both freshman year and junior year, had really seemed like this kind of Den Poet Society kind of teacher.
Yeah.
And then junior year, things kind of changed. I'm wondering if you could talk just about the scene in which you walk out of class, because that is, I was underlining furiously. I was rooting for you. And again, it seemed like such an act of self-possession and bravery on your end, for being a teenager confronting a teacher.
Yeah, didn't feel that way at the time. Yeah, so Dr. Wiles, what happened, he was this, you know, really charismatic teacher who taught, like, who taught us philosophy and taught us so many things. But by my junior year, he had gone through a sort of transformation. And he'd always dabbled in conspiracy theories and sort of been like, what do you think? You know, is there a new world order? And it was sort of seemed playful, I think, at first, but then it got more and more intense. And so the scene you're talking about is towards the end of my junior year when he showed us a debate about the Holocaust. And he showed us just the first half of the debate, saying that the Holocaust had not happened as we think it had. And I actually did not react then because in this sort of, I think this gets to, I talked to so many students, I interviewed, you know, students from that year. And one of them said, you know, we just didn't push back then. Like we just accepted what we were told. And I didn't push back when we watched that first half, but I assume that when I came back to class, the next class, we watched the response, which would say that the Holocaust did happen, as we know it did, and we learned in history. And when I came back to class, he didn't bring out the TV and he didn't show us the other side of the debate. And that was this real breaking point for me where I could actually see that he was manipulating us. It was very hard. I mean, I think that's the thing about, that's what I'm exploring in the book. And I think that's the thing that a lot of us feel right now is that it's really hard to figure out where to draw the line. Like, when is somebody lying or manipulating in a way that's kind of funny? Or when are they lying and manipulating in a way that's like not really that big of a deal? And when are they lying and manipulating in a way that's threatening democracy? Or in this case, you know, threatening our ability to know like historical fact. I don't think I could not articulate it that way at that moment in time. All I knew is that I just felt really betrayed. And so I reacted on that feeling of betrayal. But what I felt afterwards was really alone, because I think that I was the only person that reacted. And I felt, you know, kind of like I was being a hysterical girl, basically. And so, yeah, a lot of the book is trying to work through that and figure that out and what it, you know, the context of all of that.
Absolutely. And I do love the idea that I think when you describe the scene, I don't know if you felt that way at the time, but like there is this idea that, especially now, all things should be debated. And there are some things that maybe shouldn't be up for debate. Or, and where do you draw that line? What should we debate? What should we? Yeah, it's a difficult question.
Yeah. And I think I even say in the book, I feel conflicted about even bringing this up, because in bringing it up, I was able to find the video online. So I was able to sort of talk about it in more detail. It was based on memory, but, you know, I had the actual video so I could quote from it and the debate video. But I think that's complicated too. I thought there's a way in which even just telling that conspiracy theory could do harm, you know, having that out in the world, sort of allowing platform, as we could say, platforming, right? Platforming that viewpoint. But then also, I mean, what I ended up saying in the book is like, but I don't know how else to grapple with be sucked into that, what that feeling of being sucked into to that narrative and having to deal with it. But I do think there's danger in quote unquote platforming it, or in, you know, sort of giving it space. And yeah, there's no easy answers.
and yeah, I can see how Trump gets elected and this episode in your past hits differently.
Yeah. And I was thinking about what was sort of the inciting incident or like the impetus for this book. And there were a number of them, but one of them was definitely not Trump getting elected, but his rise and the narrative that what I was kind of pushing against or thinking about with this narrative that we had for a little while that like only uneducated poor whites are falling for Trump. And I wanted to push back against that. And I think the, you know, the election results showed us that it wasn't just uneducated poor whites. There were very well-educated white women that were voting for Trump, you know, and that were clearly, if not falling for his sort of conspiratorial thinking, at least accepting of it. And that's something that I was really interested in the book is like, how do we think about the way we react to that kind of rhetoric, right? Like, why do some of us push back? Why do some of us just shrug it off, right? And just say, oh, it's not a big deal. And why do some of us fall for it? Why do some of us like get really wrapped up in these conspiracy theories and conspiratorial thinking? I was really interested in thinking about that kind of more rigorously rather than just blaming one particular group for that kind of thinking.
And I love your, first of all, you keep a journal, which I think is probably key to accessing those high school memories. But then you go back and reconnect with so many of your former classmates, and you do kind of show the varying reactions that maybe not to that particular thing, but to that particular teacher, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I think that was one of the more sort of most emotionally moving parts of the book process for me, because so much of the book process was grappling with things that had already happened and trying to figure out how to make sense of them. And that's difficult, you know, intellectually and emotionally, and you know, there's really interesting challenges about that. But the talking to classmates brought up new emotions, right? Like sort of reconnecting with these people who I hadn't talked to in 20 years and hearing about the way they interpreted this one man that we all sort of shared in common was, it ended up being really emotionally moving for me, and challenging in good ways, right? Because I think that it's so easy to create a narrative of your past that feels comfortable to you. And, you know, I really wanted to try to think about that past both as like a memoirist and as a journalist. And so it felt really multidimensional, but it also felt really emotional just to hear from people in writing the book. But also since it's come out, I've heard from some of those same classmates. And one of them said to me, reading the book has made me realize that I want to take these things more seriously. And I have kids and I want to talk to them about these issues. And I thought that was really touching. You know, I'm not trying to be moralistic in the book at all. I just want us to talk about and think about some of the issues that the book's raising. And so that meant a lot to me. That idea of change, I was really interested in like myself changing and other people I talk to, what it means to change your opinions and your thoughts, not only about yourself, but about your own history and the people in that history.
And then I love that you get to talk a bunch about craft too. In talking about how to approach talking about your past. And you mentioned Virginia Woolf's notion that there's you of the past and you of the present, and those are two different people. And the thing that she doesn't address, which of course is such a key component of your book, is that you in the present is still changing.
Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of key to the book too, is that, you know, the book starts that I was writing this story about high school, and I did have, that's what felt like a static, what she calls the I now, this person we are, the person I am in this moment, writing about the past. And there's something so safe about that, right? I'm this static constant. But what happens in the book and the sort of second part is that, you know, that something happens to my I now, that I was, myself and my partner were sort of thrown into what ended up feeling like a similar situation of sort of being trapped in lies and manipulation by a completely different person. And I thought that was I mean, at the time it was horrifying and overwhelming, but in craft-wise, thinking about the book, it really was helpful because a memoir is, you know, is an examination of the self. Vivian Gornick has this distinction where she talks about memoir and essay, and she says that essay is that uses the self as a lens to understand the world, and that like the memoir uses the world as a lens to understand the self. I think I'm doing a little of both in the book, right? I'm interested in both the self, but also in like the way the self helps us understand the world outside. But complicating that sense of self felt particularly rich and important within a memoir, but I think within a book like this too, that is kind of coming out of those really basic philosophical questions, like who am I? What does it mean to be a person, et cetera? And yeah, it is really more complicated. The self you are right now could always change. And that's kind of the risk, but the joy of being alive is that, you know, we don't have control over that all the time. And there can be tragic and wonderful things that happen that completely change our lives and circumstances and what we understand of the world.
You also mentioned, of course, as another impetus for writing this book is the birth of your daughter. And yes, let's talk about the joyful one first.
Yeah. So my partner and I have two kids, and my partner carried our older daughter, and I carried the second one. So in some ways I had this experience of like watching a baby be born, but not going through the experience of birth. And then I gave birth to our daughter. So I did this really interesting thing called hypnobirth, where you hypnotize yourself during the birthing process. And I'm not a very woo-woo person. Like, I don't tend to think that like there's, I very much get into like sort of medicine, and, you know, I would have taken an epidural, but my friend said, try this. And I said, okay, I'll try it. And I did not think it would work, but it did. It was pretty amazing because I have very low pain tolerance, but I was able to sort of pass through the whole process of birth with this self-hypnotizing and have very little pain. But it all went away right when she was coming out. Right. So, and the pain suddenly, I said, like hollowed. It overwhelmed me. There was this amazing moment where I say in the book that I kind of feel like I felt like God. Like I felt like, I talk a lot about Plato's allegory, the cave, in the book, and this idea of like leaving the cave where you're deceived into this moment where you know what is what. And there was a sort of beautiful moment of clarity where I felt like I understood everything. Like I felt the wonder that Socrates talks about, and like this sort of, you know, maybe nirvana, whatever these things that we talk about as being like sort of this state that we might hope to reach. And it was very brief, but right when my daughter was born, I felt that. And it was pretty magical and intense and incredible. And I think that I really clung to that in part because it helped me think about what, amongst all this talking about, like, what's happening to truth? What, you know, like, what are all the threats that are going on right now? Like, how do we deal with, you know, so much manipulation and all of these other moments of strife in the world? I think that moment of the birth helped me remember that, like, but yes, but in being human, what is incredible is the potential for wonder, right? For this potential for some sort of state where we feel kind of connected to one another, to God, or whatever it is that you believe. And then that's also part of our understanding of truth, or whatever truth is. And so I think that I really did cling to that. You know, it was sort of there present as I was writing the book, because it, maybe as you said, it felt more hopeful. It was the sort of other side of the coin.
Yeah. And I do love an image from closer to the end of the book when you talk about embracing one another in the cage. And even if you can't come out of it, there is beauty in that too. Yeah. So Sarah, I'm wondering, the next part, of course, I read your New York Times Magazine piece. I'm wondering if how you tell the story of what happened to you has changed, and then if you can tell it too.
Yeah, it's such a complicated story. It's such a hard story to tell succinctly. I'm always relieved if somebody has read the New York Times piece, because then I can say, oh, you've already read this compact version of this story. But what I often say is that, or the way I understand it is that, somebody I knew created a series of lies about my wife and me and trapped us. In some ways, we were sort of trapped in them for a couple of months and couldn't get out of them. And specifically, what he did was he pretended to be women at our university and filed Title IX accusations against my wife, Marta. And then eventually they included me as well, and we were put under investigation. And we sort of realized the reason he had done that is because he, and this is always the complicated part, was that I had been offered a job that he was second in line for. And he knew that I would only take the job if Marta also got a spousal hire. And it's, in some ways, I think what's so complicated about telling that narrative that I just told is that there are so many steps to it, right? There's so many like layers in which like the logic of it is like, if this happens, then therefore this will happen. But I also think it's difficult to tell sometimes because it seems so unbelievable. And when it happened to us, when I realized it was him before we could prove it, but when I really felt convicted that it a strong conviction that it was him, even then it felt hard to tell people because it felt almost like I was fibbing, right? It felt like you were making up sort of this fantastical fabrication. But I wasn't. But it was, we were eventually able to find proof that it was him. I guess the sense that I make of it, I mean, I think now something that feels pretty important to me was that because he did that, because he did what sort of felt unthinkable, it meant that for a while afterwards, and still even now today, there are moments which I wonder if there might be another grand conspiracy, right? That I think it allowed me to really understand conspiratorial thinking more viscerally, because when we were being accused and weren't able to prove that there are innocence yet, there was a real feeling of desperation to sort of be able to get out under the thumb of his lies and manipulations. And my worst fear would be to return to that, and I think that I even mentioned in the book that Marta said she would divorce me if I reached out to this man and tried to interview him, because I did reach out to Dr. Wiles and tried to interview him, or did interview him. And I understood why she said that, because she just this fear that you could fall back into that, and how easy it is to potentially fall into somebody else's storytelling or somebody else's narrative and have them have control of your narrative. And I think that awareness of the vulnerability that all of us are in, that the ability that we could fall into it was really important to me, but also the awareness that like how easy it is to fall into sort of conspiratorial thinking and to feel conspiratorial about the world and how to sort of push back against that. Both of those were emotions or problems that I grappled with in the book that I don't think I had thought about when I was writing the article, right? This is something I was sort of thinking through in the book.
Yeah, and it must have been, especially when you were desperate and trying to prove your innocence. You talk about how these accusations made you think twice anyway, even though you know you didn't have parties that involved plentiful amounts of wine or whatever it was, that it still doesn't matter, that it's still unsettling and kind of puts you out of your own sense of self.
Yeah, I think that was the most disturbing and frightening to me, was that there were moments where I not only doubted Marta, that was disturbing and frightening, but that's another person. I think we could all at some point doubt, our spouse, but that I actually doubted myself. There was one accusation where the character Jessica, who was sort of created by this man Jay, said that I was lying topless on a bed. And at the first moment, it seemed ridiculous. But then in her accusation, she also said that there was a painting on my wall, which there was a painting on my wall. And I just couldn't let go of that. There was a glitch. It was almost like there was a glitch in my brain where I was like, maybe this did happen, right? That was really, really frightening, because it suddenly felt like maybe I don't know myself. That's the question. Who am I? Right. And to doubt yourself and your own memories to such an extreme. I think we all sometimes doubt small memories, but such an important potential memory to doubt that felt really, really frightening. And it was kind of amazing how easy it was to fall into that temporary state of doubt.
And one of the things you point out after you explain the entire Jay ordeal is that you realize that both he and Dr. Wiles and you and your spouse are teachers. And that connects you in a really meaningful way, it seems.
Yeah. And so with Socrates and, you know, and Plato, who yeah. were sort of like hovering in the background of all that discussion. And, you know, Plato's allegory of the cave is a lot about, it's very much about education. Yeah, that was something I just started to think so much about, partially because I was also thinking about democracy. You know, I was thinking about this idea of our democracy and what does it mean for us to have a shared reality and actually like invest in that shared reality, and how there's obviously splinters in that right now. And that is arguably a threat to democracy, but thinking about within that, the way that the role that educators play. And I was really interested in thinking about education and benefits and harm, and not an easy black and white version of that, because I think that Dr. Wiles, I really do think there were so many benefits to the way that he educated us. And I'm so appreciative. But I also think it's very clear to see that there were harms in the way that he was interacting. And so, yeah, I was really interested in, and continue to be interested in, the way that educators, the power that educators have, right? And I don't talk about this as much in this book, but I do think a lot about our world. You know, I've been thinking about starting my daughters are in elementary school, and I recently talked to the principal about starting a newspaper club in their elementary school, and how amazing that would be, because if they could, I mean, I in the book, there's a scene where I'm in journalism class, right? And I'm on the school newspaper. And that was really formative to me, because that's one way in which people can learn about the importance of journalism. And it's vital, right? It's really vital to this world. But I think philosophy as well, you know, and literature. I mean, the book is full of literature, but like this idea of being able to teach and share stories. And in some ways, that's my larger conclusion, is that, okay, we have fact checking, we have journalism, we have a lot of things that we're trying to grapple with the problem in various ways. But I really do think we need stories, like, and we need to value stories, like, and not just nonfiction memoirs like mine, but also like novels. Like we need to, I think you and I value them, but as a sort of culture, we need to value the ways in which poetry and novels and memoirs and everything else contribute to our understanding of what is real, right? And like, and the community that we all share, right? And the importance of those works.
Sarah, this seems to be a great opportunity to ask. I have so many other questions I can ask you, but I'm going to stop and ask you to talk about some books you'd like to recommend.
Well, so I've been on a huge Janet Malcolm kick as of late. You know, I had some essay that talked about, I hadn't realized that she and Joan Didion were born in the same year and died in the same year. And I've always loved Joan Didion. I'm an essayist, of course I do, but I had not read as much of Janet Malcolm until recently. And so I teach The Journalist and the Murderer. I taught a true crime class not long ago. And I taught that, but then I've just been reading a number of her other standalone books. And I am in love with the way that she really, lets people talk in her work, and like sometimes lets them indict themselves, but also I just recently read Into the Freud Archives, and you know, the characters in there just go on and on and on, and there's almost as if you're an analyst, right? Like analyzing what they say, but also the way she really zeroes in on conflict, right? And like trying to understand the central conflict and using it to teach us something bigger about humanity, right? And the way that we are as people. I just think she's brilliant, both structurally and the way she uses characters. And then more recently, like more recent work, the other one I was going to recommend is When We Cease to Understand the World by Benjamin Labatut. I adored that book, came out a couple of years ago, but I think about it all the time, in part because I'm really interested in fact versus fiction. And he does these really clever things in which, you know, the first story is almost completely factual, except for like one paragraph, I think, of fiction. And then it sort of moves into more fictional mode, but he's still grappling with issues of sort of power and politics and science in the world. I love that. And then the last one I'll say, I just read Big Swiss by Jean Begin, and I adored it. I thought it was really funny, but structurally, I'm really interested in structure. Structurally, I just thought it was perfect. And I love the way that by the end of the book, you suddenly felt this real depth for this central protagonist. And I don't think you felt at the beginning. I feel like that was purposeful. So this real switch in understanding of our narrator and protagonist, I thought was brilliant. And it's really funny. So those are some recommendations.
Sarah, thank you so much. To Name the Bigger Lie is out now.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.